Storylines New England is a project of the American Library Association, funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities.
David Dearborn connects people to their pasts. As reference librarian for the New England Historic Genealogical Society, David has spent almost 30 years sifting through old records, ledgers, and books, helping New Englanders and others learn more about their family histories, where they came from, and where they settled.
The Connecticut River Valley area of central Massachusetts is a large Polish population out there. Lowell, it's noted for its Greek population. Watertown, Massachusetts, of course, has the biggest concentration of Armenians in New England. In fact, the second largest in the United States.
Through the years, David has discovered more than simply the facts about the families who settled in Massachusetts, Vermont, Connecticut, New Hampshire, Maine, and Rhode Island. He's also learned a great deal about who we are as New Englanders and how we've come to define ourselves.
A lot of times I think the attitude of the New Englander is, why should I go anywhere else when I'm already here? We have our own accent, we have our own peculiarities and customs, and because we're tucked in a corner of the United States, we look to ourselves, I think, for our own influences. We don't look at Hollywood, we don't look at Washington, we certainly don't look at New York. We react negatively to some of these customs that other parts of the country might adapt and say, well, you know, we may adapt those, we may not, but we're just going to do what we want, and we don't care what other people think of us. We're comfortable with who we are.
From the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio, welcome to Storylines New England. I'm Laura Canoy.
And I'm Kevin Gardner. Storylines is a 13-part series that looks at the literature of New England. We'll look at the works of Robert Frost, Edith Wharton, John Irving, and many others as a way to better understand who we are as New Englanders and as Americans.
But Storylines is more than just a show about books. Each week, as we address a particular New England author's work, we'll also look at the issues it raises as we search for insights about where we've been, where we are now, and where we're heading. This week on Storylines New England, we meet Massachusetts writer Jane Brox, whose book 5,000 Days Like This One, An American Family History, takes a deeply personal look at New England's and America's immigrant story.
It's been said that family histories begin, in a way, with death, that it's a catalyst to look backward. And Jane Brox's story is no different. Her beautifully written memoir, 5,000 Days Like This One, begins with the death of her father, who operates a small farm close to the Massachusetts-New Hampshire border. In the aftermath of his death, Brox grapples with everything from outstanding bills and receipts to the thousand daily decisions of farm life. Yet she finds herself compelled to learn more, to explore her family's history. She traces their emigration from Lebanon and Italy to the immigrant city of Lawrence, Massachusetts, and describes their life and work in the city's enormous textile mills. Then she follows them a few miles west to the farm they eventually bought and settled on.
For Jane Brox, her family's story is also the story of the Merrimack River and its fertile valley, which runs from the White Mountains of New Hampshire down across northern Massachusetts to the Atlantic Ocean. From mill town to mill town, where cloth dust fell, quote, constant as mountain flurries, and through passing eras of settlement, agriculture, and manufacturing. Throughout this book, Jane Brox locates the people who live there. Yankees, Syrians, Poles, Belgians, Greeks, and many others as part of the history of the land itself. For her, their languages, foods, and customs have left continuous, overlapping marks on the landscape, marks you can still see if you look closely as that landscape changes once again.
Northeastern Massachusetts is so congested now that, except in a few conscientious towns, the original settlement centers are lost in sprawl. A white steeple church here, a barn connected to a farmhouse there, stand as specimens preserved among new developments and restaurants, stores, and strip malls. They're hardly enough to give a sense of an earlier time, but claim their place the way a wolf tree does in a regrown woods. The wolf tree's long branches reach out and up, its crown having spread out in the full sunlight of an open field in the years before the younger trees sprouted up around it. It stands as a marker of time passing and gone, and a share of its beauty is drawn from the fact of its survival, from the fact of its standing still beside the sway of supple birches and the sweep of pines. They startle you, those wolf trees, when you come upon them in the woods, alone always, and as arresting as the clear yellow eye of their namesake.
Although Jane Brock's book is centered on her own family and her family's small farm, its story is a large one. Those before us who came to the New World for a better life, those whose families settled here and today struggle to hold on to their identities in a fast-changing region, and those who've only recently arrived all seek, in New England's land, cities, rivers, and mountains, some way of defining who they are and where they've come from.
Today on Storylines New England, we look at 5,000 Days Like This One, an American family history, and through it, at the immigrant story, at the story of the struggling family farm, at maintaining our regional identities, and at our much-altered relationship with New England's varied landscape.
And we want to hear from you, your stories, and your family's stories of coming to America. Why did you or your family settle here? What kept you from leaving? What struggles did you face, coming here or staying here? What connects you with your land, and how do we struggle to maintain our identity in a growing and changing New England? Our number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477.
Joining us now in the studio is Jane Brocks, author of 5,000 Days Like This One, along with David Waters, director of the Center for New England Culture at the University of New Hampshire and an advising scholar for Storylines New England. He'll be joining us throughout the series. Jane Brocks, what a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
David Waters, always good to see you. Thank you very much.
Well, nice to be here, Laura and Kevin.
And I'll start with you, Jane, but clearly, David, I want you on this. When you read the book 5,000 Days Like This One, there's a story of attraction and attachment, people attracted to New England from places as far away as Italy and Lebanon. And then once they get here, an attachment. They don't want to leave. What is it, Jane and David, about New England that has this quality that both attracts people and attaches people?
Well, I think part of it is, you know, my ancestors came here for opportunity, clearly economical opportunities. And then I think once here, they became part of a larger history, a history that had been going on for hundreds of years. And they found their way into that world and built on top of a previous world. So there's a real sense of accumulation, of already inheriting something and taking it on. I mean, when I think of my grandfather and grandmother buying a farm that had already existed for 100 years that was on the wane, and then they saw in their impoverished state an opportunity to take something on the wane and carry it a little further, I think that helped to sort of build an identity for them and an allegiance that carried through.
That's the attachment.
Yeah.
David?
Well, you know, New England has such strong images for people. It seems like America's first place. You know, we have the images of the pilgrims, and it can offer religious freedom. And then we have patriotic heroes and rebels and reformers, and particular economic opportunity. That here was America's first industrial society and first global society. And it really has become a magnet for people who have a dream, who want to find a new place in America. And New England's an old place that way, but it's also a place that's then is changing so much all the time. And I think that New Englanders have had to invent ways to become attached. They're so used to so much loss of a family, of a farm, of a way of life. And so how do we know who we are? Who were we? What country did we come from? But how do we know who we are as New Englanders? And those are the kind of questions that come up with New England in a wonderful book like this.
David, what can you say about the way that immigrants encounter the sort of self-perpetuating mythology of New England? And as a sort of follow-up, Jane, how do you feel that your own family encountered that? You said before that they've felt that they were carrying on something with respect to the farm itself. But what about the way that New Englanders have felt about themselves on farms?
Well, Jane talks a lot about the example of Henry David Thoreau, who recognized a particular quality of New England life in our democracy coming from rugged individualists who live on their farms and make their way and try to better their families, but they're also part of a community that here you can join together with other like-minded people, whether in town meeting or in farm associations or the Grange, and find a way into community and into connection.
Yes, the farms all throughout Draycott, the town where our farm is, a lot of the old Yankee farms were taken over by immigrants, and there was sort of this melding of identity. The Poles and the Lebanese took on some of the Yankee aspects of the old farmers, and they melded together in a kind of in a difficult community at times, but a very coherent community. They would all go to the dances and the Grange together, even though there was a suspicion of the newcomers.
You do talk in your book about a kind of ambivalence on the part of those who were already there running farms. I know that at one point you mentioned that one neighbor tried to expose your grandfather's hard cider making, and another one wanted to help your uncle go to college.
Right,
so there's a kind of dichotomy there in the neighborhood, isn't there?
Well, also, I think when a new group comes in, you see the fading of your own. You know, you see the fading of your own culture and their ascendancy. So I think that was a lot of it.
1-800-892-6477 is the number. We are taking your calls today on Storylines New England. I'm Laura Canoy, along with Kevin Gardner. And today on Storylines New England, we're looking at New England's immigrant history and its tradition of small family farms through the pages of 5,000 Days, like this one by Jane Brox. It's the story of her immigrant parents, their work in the textile mills, and then as small farmers. We want to hear from you. Does your family have a similar story? Join us, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Tell us what drew your relatives to New England and what kept them here. 1-800-892-6477 is the number, 1-800-892-NHPR. Along with Jane Brox is David Waters. He is director of the Center for New England Culture at the University of New Hampshire and an advising scholar for Storylines New England. Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. I want to bring a reading from the book to our audience now. It has to do with what both of you touched on, the immigrants coming here for economic opportunity to work in the textile mills, as your family did, Jane Brox. And yet the economic opportunity that they encountered was very difficult. I mean, they weren't coming into cushy jobs and, you know, just saying, hey, this is great, isn't this new world wonderful? Let's hear what working conditions were like in many of New England's early textile mills.
The noise in the weave rooms was loud enough to break the sleep of earth. The whole place vibrated, and the workers would be shaking, their ears ringing as they left at the end of the day. The money was small. The same thing over and over as they labored under the threat of stretchouts and speed-ups, of grudges that could slow the work down and affect pay. If the loom fixer had something against you, he'd skip over you and go on. The mill bells, the mill gates closing at 6 a.m., sharp. Piece rate. There was a premium system under which, once the required amount was earned, workers received additional wages only if the work was performed in an unbroken 4-week period. A day's absence canceled their premium.
A reading from Jane Brox's 5,000 Days Like This One, talking about New England's immigrant history. And David Waters, just how significant was the immigrant presence in New England's textile industry?
Well, it was enormous. The 25,000 people who went out in strike in Lawrence in 1912, probably half were Franco-Americans, and then you had Greeks and Lebanese and Poles, and they really were the laborers who built New England's textile industries. And it really shows the great contrast when you think about what is the real New England. Is it the New England of the small farm and the family and those rugged individuals, or is it this enormous industrial complex which, you know, pulls workers in and chews them up and spits them out? And that great 1912 Lawrence strike for bread and roses, which says we need bread. We can't have 8 cents or 16 cents taken out of our paycheck because we're getting fewer hours, but we also want life to mean something. We want roses, too. And I think that's a very New England value there, that life should mean something, that we are important. We are factory workers, but we are humans, too.
And Jane Brocks, for people who haven't had a chance to read your book, just what was your family's connection to the mills?
Well, my father's family came from Lebanon to Lawrence, but very quickly afterwards moved to the farm, found the opportunity of the farm. My mother's family moved to Lawrence at the end of the 19th century and stayed there all their lives. My grandfather was a weaver in one of the mills in Lawrence. So a lot of the immigrant, my interest in Lawrence came from his stories. He died when I was very young, but I always remember they lived on the third floor of a tenement and going to Lawrence to visit them. And also the proximity of that world to the farm. They were only 6 miles away, which was which seemed like a great disjuncture every time we went.
You're listening to Storylines New England. I'm Kevin Gardner, along with Laura Kanoy, and we're exploring New England's diverse immigrant culture and the fate of its small family farms with author Jane Brocks and our resident scholar, David Waters. Jane, there's something very interesting about the way that your family, or elements of it at any rate, began in the mills, came to America to work in the mills, and then apparently seemed to migrate out toward a farming life. That is sort of the opposite of the kind of old mythological story that we're so used to in terms of New England history, where migration comes out of the farm and goes toward the mills. So I wanted to ask you what you know about how typical that kind of movement was. Is that a facet of the immigrant story we're just not aware of?
Well, I think so. I mean, I don't think there were masses moving out into the country. By then, by the end of the 19th century, farming was certainly in decline in New England. It was in decline in Thoreau's time. But in fact, there were these opportunities out there. And also, as the cities grew, the demand for, say, milk in the cities of Lawrence and Lowell grew. And so there was an opportunity for those herds, milk herds, to rise up, to become larger once again. And so the immigrants saw the opportunity. And the farms were, you know, our farm, the soil was rocky. It wasn't a great thing to have bought, but I think in their circumstances, they saw the benefits of it.
Sure, sure. David, this is a good place, and Jane has provided a wonderful segue for me to ask you was Jane Brocks's grandfather lucky to show up to look for a farm in 1901? Are there other periods of American history when he would have had a much tougher time finding himself a farm near Lawrence?
Well, farming really was on the way down in New England that time. I mean, Robert Frost is another example, coming to start a farm in 1900 when there were 10,000 abandoned farms in northern New England. And so there was opportunity there. Governor of New Hampshire said all the lively ones have got up and out, gone west to flatter farms or gone to work in the mills. But these cities did need fresh food. Railroads could bring in wheat from the Midwest, but you wanted fresh milk, you wanted fresh eggs. And then, you know, people also wanted the food that tasted like home. Who could grow those ethnic foods that you could then put in your bread or in your stew? And that's true today. You know, ethnic farming is very big today because of new groups, particularly Asian ones, who want to get the vegetables that they can cook. And you go down to Lowell or Lawrence and to the markets, and you're going to find Cambodian vegetables and spices. And so there is this interesting opportunity for kind of renewing farm traditions, very Yankee connected in a way in the independence, but also something very new, new faces, new language, new foods, but a real connection to the New England story.
1-800-892-6477 is our number, 1-800-892-NHPR. This is Storylines New England. I'm Laura Kanoy, along with Kevin Gardner, and our guests, Jane Brocks and David Waters. We want to hear your stories, your immigrant stories, your family coming to New England. Why did they choose New England? Why did they decide to stay here? 1-800-892-6477 is the number, 1-800-892-NHPR. Let's go first to Burlington, Vermont. Jean is calling from there. Jean, welcome to Storylines New England. You're on the air.
That's so exciting. Hi, how are you?
Fine.
The story I want to share is about my family. I come from a family that came from Quebec, probably 30 or 40 miles away. And I asked my dad once why they came to Vermont. It was difficult. They didn't know the language. And he said that at that time, they saw that Vermont was a land of opportunity. The United States was a land of opportunity. And I just found that amazing, that they could see a difference in countries and in characteristics, literally a car drive away. This was during the 20s and the 30s that they did come down. So that was a very real pull to, for French Canadians even during that time.
Did you speak French in the home, Jean?
My parents do. I don't.
Uh-huh. That's typical, isn't it?
It's very common, yes.
And how do you feel about that?
Oh, I regret the loss of my ethnic background, of course. It's, as you said, it is very typical. At that time, I don't think people particularly wanted to hold on to a lot of the characteristics of where they came from. The future was everything.
You know, what you're saying, Jean, is so echoed so much in Jane Brock's book. And Jane and David, I want to hear from both of you on this. Jane, first, what she's saying reminds me of things that I read in your book about your only connection to that Lebanese and Italian history was food.
Right.
Which
right.
I have nothing against food, but, you know.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, they definitely wanted us to become something other than what they had been. And, you know, my father, especially I think being in the country, they spoke less Arabic than some of the city dwellers did, who might have lived in a little Arabic ghetto in the city. But in the country, they had to learn English very quickly. And so even my father and his brothers didn't know English, didn't know Arabic, except for a few words here and there. And I knew even less except for the words. But it was certainly, you know, part of becoming an American and embracing this country and not looking back.
And how do you feel about that now, that you didn't learn to speak those languages?
Well, I, you know, there's a little regret there, but I understand completely. I'm just glad that I learned how to cook all that food.
David, I want to ask you about the other part of Jean's question, the Quebecois contribution to New England was enormous. It cannot be overstated, the impact of people from Quebec on the shaping of this region's identity.
Well, the French Canadians really built the New England economy in the second half of the 19th century, especially in the northern states. And, you know, even today, close to a third of New Hampshire people have some French Canadian background. And, you know, they not only brought a labor force, but they also brought a language and they brought a church with them, too. And I think that
Catholicism.
That's, yeah, that and that Catholicism is really the important story of the last two centuries of New England life. And that being able to hear a mass in your own language, whether it's Arabic or French or Greek, and then being able to commune with your own priest and in your own neighborhood, and have the foods that you're going to have after Sunday mass. That's that holding on to something. And I think that's been the New England immigrant story of how do you hold on to your past? Do you feel like you're in between two worlds? Do you always think you're going to go home again, as a lot of people thought they would go back to Canada or would visit because it's just a train trip away, farther and harder to get back to Lebanon or Syria. But there's that draw, and I think the language really and the food brings back that sense of memory and what do I want to keep alive of my old self even as I'm becoming a New Englander.
Jane, in your new book, you speak of immigrants of an earlier period trying to create for themselves a past that was free from the past. Mm-hmm. Is there a tension in families like yours between the effort to hold on to ways and foods and customs of the old country and the effort to acclimate themselves to something new in America while at the same time looking for ways to discard parts of their either ethnic or political past that are distasteful to them or cause fear or anxiety?
Certainly. And I think of that especially when I think of education because I was one of my father's brothers went on to college. My father went on to agricultural school. But for us, it was really my parents were intent on getting us to college as the first generation. And that, I feel, that was a great separation between one generation and another, that difference in education, that difference in expectations. For as much as, you know, we were taught to embrace family life, we were also always expected to leave the farm. And that tension was always within the family. I mean, especially as a girl, I think, in the family. There was no real place for me on the farm as a child. And it was expected that if the farm was to continue, it would be with one of my brothers. So that as a woman, especially, I think that disjuncture is especially deep.
Let's take another call. This one from Manchester, New Hampshire. It's Bob on the air. Bob, you're on Storylines New England. Thanks for calling.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
This is a great show. It's really interesting. I was on your show last year talking about immigrants in Manchester. So, and hello, David.
Hi, Bob.
Bob Perot. How you doing?
I'm very well. It's nice of you to call. You certainly know this story.
Very much so. I just wanted to mention, in my family, we had actually both sides of the family were quite different. My father's family went down very, very early to Massachusetts and then eventually to Connecticut, where they were working class people, mainly working in mills down there, whereas my mother's family came down from Quebec. One side went to Woonsocket and worked in mills, but my grandfather, my maternal grandfather, had an education, and he just absolutely hated farm work in Quebec. And so he came down first to Woonsocket, Rhode Island, to marry my grandmother, and then they came up to Manchester, and he worked as a journalist here, a French-language journalist. So there are really two classes, I think, of immigrants that came down. There were the educated class and the working class.
What do you think, David Waters?
Well, isn't it amazing how, even since the time Adam first busted sod east of Eden, that people have thought that the farm is a place to get away from and that economic opportunity was in the cities. And just a very, very strong pull. And it really shows how New England was just such a temptation. And here are these places where you could start from nothing and get into the mills and work yourself up and get an education and join that life.
You know, it is this reversal, though, that we talked about earlier, that, you know, people came mostly to work at the mills to get off of the farm. Again, the girls from Quebec, the poor family farms, came and saw this as a shining opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And then some go back, because I think that's the other part of New England's culture and history is that, you know, are there certain values that if you don't learn them on the farm, you don't learn them anywhere else? Being close to the land, understanding those soils, the language for apple blossom and apple buds, that how else are you going to know those things? And that there's maybe something, you know, very spiritual about that for some people, that connection can't be found anywhere else but on a farm.
Bob, I want to ask you a question.
Yeah.
What did that immigrant history mean to you? How did that sort of shape your identity as a New Englander?
Well, it certainly made me, I think, stand out from a lot of other people. Number one, I'm bilingual. I feel bilingual and bicultural. So right away, I feel that I have been able to benefit from the richness of having two languages and two cultures. And that the grandfather that I mentioned before, who was a journalist, he made sure that French was spoken in the family. On my father's side of the family, because they were coming down from Connecticut, they tended to be more Anglophone. So I kind of benefited from both sides, if you want, the Yankee Franco-American side and the Quebec Franco-American side.
Well, Bob, it's great to hear from you, and thank you for calling. Coming up after a break, more on New England's and America's immigrant story and a close look at the fate of the New England family farm as seen through the pages of Jane Brox's 5,000 Days Like This One. And we'll take your phone calls 1-800-892-6477.
For more information on Storylines New England or the books that we're reading, visit our website, storyline.ala.org, or check out your local public library. Libraries have copies of the books, program schedules, and our discussion guides. I'm Kevin Gardner.
And I'm Laura Canoy. You're listening to Storylines New England.
Storylines New England is a project of the American Library Association, funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities.
From the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Storylines New England. I'm Laura Kanoy.
And I'm Kevin Gardner. We're talking today about the immigrant story in New England and in America through the pages of Jane Brox's 5,000 Days Like This One, An American Family History. It's a lyrical book that takes a look at the land, the culture, and the people who settled along New England's Merrimack River. It's also a personal memoir, a family stocktaking that describes Jane Brox's effort to fully understand the small farm whose management she undertook in the aftermath of her father's death, the land, the people, and the history. The stories of farms like these are both quintessentially New England and quintessentially American. Yet farmers everywhere have long struggled with major changes due to everything from global competition to expanding suburbs. Jane Brox captures something of that struggle in this passage, read by actress Brenda Foley.
Who's going to be farming in this valley 10 years from now? Who? My father once asked. I could say nothing in the face of the long years he had put in. I realize I know little of the work it will be, even though it's not a great deal of land. These acres he has left are almost nothing in comparison to the farms to the west, to farms in general. But it is ours, and one of the last here, and it feels huge to me.
Jane Brox's family story is not unique. The handful of New England family farms still in operation today face not only traditional difficulties, short growing seasons, unpredictable weather, impossible economic conditions, but also have to cope with the new challenges, such as rampant development, exploding land values, and alterations in the preferences of the marketplace. Even the nomenclature has changed. People refer less to farming, tending toward 21st century terms like agro-entertainment to describe what small landowners do. Diamond Hill Farm on the outskirts of Concord, New Hampshire, is one such place. The produce and hay farm has been in operation for almost 170 years, yet struggles constantly to remain viable. Farm manager Jane Presby's story is similar to Jane Brox's. She, too, inherited the burdens of running her family farm after her father died. Storyline's producer Keith Shields recently met with Presby on her farm to talk about her memories, along with the rewards and challenges of New England small farming today.
As people walk down through the barn, they can see, like if you put some kind of
life on the farm as a kid was great, because we had all this property we could run around. There were people working here. We had pigs and chickens and cows, and it was a busy place. So we were never bored. We worked hard, but it was all part of a day that was a good day. And hopefully today, when people come visit the farm, it's also a great place for people to remember. Older people come in all the time and they remember about their childhood growing up on a farm that doesn't exist anymore. I think there's a need to keep farms around for farm stands, for fresh produce, but I'm not going to say it's easy.
Alrighty.
After my father died, the farm came my way as far as managing the farm, and it's changed quite a bit as far as how are you going to make the farm appealing and find a market out there where the farm can keep growing. And so far that's been pretty successful. I think each year gets a little better. The thing about farming that's so difficult is the fact that you have to tend to the land, you have to feed it, you have to prepare it. It's an ongoing thing where you just can't take and take and take from the land. You have to give back to it. So it's not an inexpensive enterprise by any means.
How many years of corn you got?
Six.
6 years of corn?
Okay.
Grand total is going to be $4.42.
Okay. Okay.
Out of 20.
The main purpose for me as far as running this farm is to try to have it self-sufficient. I am a teacher. That has been my full-time job. And I'll be retiring from teaching. Going into this retirement, I want this farm to be able to bring in income. And so I put a great deal of effort and time into it to bring it to the point where I feel as if I can do that now. Farming is expensive. Farming has changed tremendously over time with upgrades of equipment, of technology, knowing what to do to control insects, knowing what to do to control what's the best kind of crops to grow. So many, many variables in farming, but just having more knowledge makes it probably more successful faster.
Hey, Chris! Penny, give the keys.
I think Jane Brock's book, my story, is so similar. I mean, even at the get-go with her dad, I was talking on the phone with my dad, and 10 minutes later, I was over here at the farm giving my father CPR. And I remember saying, oh, what's going to happen to the farm? Do I want to just sell it? I just couldn't do that. I just think that this piece of land is, it's a resource for the city. It's a place where people like to come. And I think in the book, I think that same feeling is there. You know, it's a farmer thing. You are a part of it. You know, your history is this land. It's the stories over time that come about from moving the original farmhouse two houses up the road by having everybody come in and they take rollers and they bring their horses and they bring their oxen and they move the house from one foundation to the other. And you can just see it. You know, you walk around the farm and you can see all of the stone walls and all of the labor it took to clear these stones out of these fields. And it's just part of you. A huge part of you. Gooseys! Oh, gooseys! Oh, gooseys! Oh, gooseys! If I were to close the farm, I can't even go there in my head. I feel a responsibility for the farm. I think my mom and my dad, I think they would like to see the farm stay going forever. I'm sure that the people before them felt the same way. It's just the fact of who's going to do it, who will take the farm forward in time. Can the farm be an easement? Can the farm be open space for people to walk on, you know, 50 years from now? Is that a possibility? I don't know. I haven't even gone there yet in my head.
Thank you very much, guys.
Have a good day.
You too.
Thank you.
Today on Storylines New England, we're talking with Jane Brocks, author of 5,000 Days Like This One, along with David Waters, Storyline scholar and director of the Center for New England Culture, about the fate of the family farm and the New England immigrant story. And we want your stories of New England family farming, your immigrant story, how your family came to New England, why it decided to stay. If you're still on a New England farm, we'd love to hear from you. What struggles do you face as a small farmer here in New England? Our number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. And let's go to a call. Lucy is calling from Greenfield, New Hampshire. Lucy, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, this is Lucy, and I was struck by your conversation today of how directly that's the life I tend to be living at the moment. My family were some of the first settlers in New England, and my ancestral village was Danvers, Massachusetts, the old Salem, and they had been maybe 14 or 15 generations in Danvers, dairy farming. By the time suburbanization engulfed the town. And most of those people are now scattered around northern New Hampshire and Maine, where they retreated to, I think, stay in a culture that was still rural and interesting to them. My grandfather sold the family dairy and farm in Danvers in the 60s when it was no longer possible to make a living. He was the last person to hay the fields underneath the Liberty Tree Mall. And the farming equipment all went up to Saco, Maine with my uncle. And as you said earlier, my mother couldn't get off the farm fast enough. And I had a professional life and have recently returned to farming.
Oh, when, Lucy?
About 3-4 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And what made you do that?
Well, I had a child. And my career was a train wreck with having a child, the one I had. And I also felt that I couldn't pass on my New England culture properly, the culture that I had inherited, outside the small family farm. Now, I'm in a luxurious position in that my husband makes a living, and we don't have to do the very hard work of trying to survive on a small farm income. But we feel like we're building community and healing a piece of land and producing organic food. I think that the future in that niche of farming may be that farming returns in somewhat to New England because we now have a lot of disposable income settled right close by us because we are very densely populated part of the country.
Right. So there's a market there for people who want the experience of going to the farm stand, of buying that organic produce. Have you found that to be the case, Jane Brocks?
Yes, that's very much true, especially in the suburbs, say around Boston, where there is that large income and people will spend more for food. And that helps to keep the farms going. When I was a child, my father would wholesale, I'd say, 80 to 90% of his produce. He would take it to the markets in Lawrence and Lowell and sell it to the small corner stores there. When I returned to the farm in the 1980s, by then we sold probably 90% of our produce on a farm stand on a very busy road because suburbia had grown up around the farm.
Jane, you have we've been talking about 5,000 days like this one, but you have a brand new book called Clearing Land, and that takes up some of the same issues that you're talking about, of course, in 5,000 days and in your first book as well. But I'm going to read you a little quote from Clearing Land in which you say, "I wonder what this place will be like without farmers. What does it mean to want their life to remain, to count on them for a sense of gravity, even if I could never abide the same demands on myself?" So I'm asking you, what does it mean? What does it mean for us to start to treasure more and more little isolated farms which are part of the community in the sense of being retail outlets as well as farms?
Well, there's a real, I think, romanticization of the farm in our culture now. And I also think the culture at large is becoming, farming was a very active way of being in the world, of being in the natural world, and we're becoming much more passive in the way we look at the world. We view the world more than partake of it. It's interesting when the town fathers are talking about preserving land in Draycott, and especially farmland, they talk about preserving the viewshed rather than talking about the quality of the soil or the inclines of the hills and what will make it a good agricultural land. They're talking about the way it looks from the road.
Right.
And I think that says everything about the way our sensibility has shifted as a culture.
It's almost as though, David Waters, the existence of farms has become a commodity in and of itself. Do you find that true?
Oh, I think it is, and it's part of the consumer culture now that Jane is describing. I mean, we see the remnants of real farms all around us, and the stone walls and the pastures and the farmhouse in the middle of a housing development. And we have a sense that here was something authentic that we don't have now in our lives, and that if we could eat the food or go to the petting zoo or pick the apples that are picked during the week by the Jamaican migrant labor, that we are connecting to that. Now, I think it's easy to make light of that, but I also turn the other side, that the people really do want to connect themselves, their families, and their children to the natural landscape, and that they do treasure farms and farmers for that. So it is part of the consumer society, but I think there is also something there that is a much deeper spiritual and historical connection, and maybe it does bode for, you know, another blossoming of farms in the future, maybe in northern New England, farther on up, or maybe around the cities. But I don't think farms are going to ever die out in New England, because I think this need is very deep, and besides, the soil's pretty good in some places too.
Although that word viewshed really just speaks volumes, doesn't it?
It does.
And we're going to be talking next week on Storylines New England about Robert Frost and the poets that came after him, and there's a lot of the New England farm and that whole image in that. Let's go back to our callers. Again, the number here on Storylines New England, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy, along with co-host Kevin Gardner, and our guests today are Jane Brocks, author of 5,000 Days Like This One, and David Waters, director of the Center for New England Culture at the University of New Hampshire. 1-800-892-6477 is the number here. And we're going next to West Barnett, Vermont. Terry joins us on the air. Hello, Terry. Go ahead.
Hello. How are you?
Fine.
I'm a seventh-generation farm family from West Barnett. My ancestor came over in 1787. He was Alexander McLeroy, but dropped the McLee, and now he's just Roy. And they've been farming the same piece of land for over 220 years, and now my Uncle Bruce owns it and farms it with his family, and the eighth generation is on the farm now. He came over here, married the boss's daughter, and inherited the farm, and he was from, he was from Stirling, and he was from the Scottish American Company, which was a group of people that came over for the land grants under the Galbraiths, who were considered the lords of the Scottish lords, and we've been there ever since, and continue to thrive in West Barnet.
Well, Terry, what does it mean to you as a New Englander to be part of this long family farm tradition?
It means so much to me because it's like a place, like home, like that's where I belong. That's where, you know, everybody knows who you are. Everybody knows who your grandparents are and your great-grandparents and your children, and knows where you lived and knows where you went to school and everything.
And Terry, you know, we talked about how farms today are sort of a tourist commodity in a way. People talk about the view shed and how tourists like to drive along and see the family farm, and it's kind of quaint. And someone used the word trophy farms. You know, they're these sort of picturesque places that people go to pet the llamas and pick their own blueberries. As a serious farmer, as a seventh-generation farmer, how do you feel about that?
Well, actually, it's my Uncle Bruce who owns the farm, but I can talk to a little bit about it. It's a family tradition in the farm to invite people up into the farm, and my great-grandfather had, in the 1930s, a burgeoning business of inviting people from New York City to stay at the farm. So it's a family tradition in a certain sense. And I think that anything that will keep the family farm going and keep it and in the family is a good thing.
Terry, thank you so much for calling.
David Waters, we've talked a lot about a lot of different things here, about mills, about farms, about different ethnicities. We haven't talked very much about the geographical diversity of New England, but I want to ask you this question in a general sense. The minute you start to talk seriously about the area of New England, a lot of the mythologies tend to fall away, and you begin to see some tiny little fiefdoms, a lot of diversity, and much more diversity than I think people who are used to looking at New England from a distance might care to acknowledge or might have any experience with. Do you think this kind of ethnic, of avocational and geographical diversity is one of the reasons why it's sometimes difficult to characterize what might be described as the essence of New England as its identity culturally?
Well, you know, New England is extraordinarily diverse, not only in its ecology. You have a coastal plain, you have mountains, you have great watersheds like the Merrimack, and then upland countries like the mountains. And then you look at those kind of niches where different populations live, and it is so very diverse. New England was the first global society. It was so diverse by the 1840s and 50s. And today there's more first-generation and second-generation born New Englanders than there have been since the 1890s. So it's extraordinarily diverse place. You know, Terry's call reminds me, a scratch of a miner, find a Scot. And you know, immigrants,
I never heard that before, David.
Well, immigrants had a way of finding a landscape that was like the one they left behind where they could recreate their life. And whether it's in Vermont for the Scots, or, you know, whether it's in the Merrimack River Valley for the Greeks and the Italians and the Poles and the Syrians, that's one of the reasons people hold on so hard to the local places. And New England is made up of the local, and we find different kinds of bread, different kinds of way of living, different kinds of way of talking, and that's why New England is so marvelous in its diversity.
And you're following onto something else that Jane Brocks talks about in her book 5,000 Days Like This One, David. And Jane, that is the new immigrants who are also influencing farming in New England.
Right.
Talk about that a little bit more. There's some really nice examples in the book of that new immigrant influence on family farms such as yours.
Right. I mean, it's interesting. A lot of the workers on the farms now will be Hispanic. And a lot of the cultures in Lawrence especially is Hispanic, so you have to grow the Hispanic crops for those people.
Such as
different kinds of squash, tomatillos, different kinds of peppers, hot peppers.
Do those things grow up here? I mean,
oh, sure,
you have a short
sure,
growing season.
Sure, yeah, they grow. And, you know, farming has become very sophisticated. You can extend the growing season in all different kinds of ways now with row covers and all that sort of thing. But I just look at the things that David, who manages the farm now, grows, and I think my father's probably turning over in his grave at the thought of this. But he would grow things for the Lebanese and Italians in Lawrence. He grew eggplants and peppers and a certain kind of Lebanese squash called kousa. So it's just, it is that farmers have to find their market, as one of the callers said, and they will grow what the public demands.
Let's go back to the phones, 1-800-892-6477 to Barrytown, Vermont, and Xenia's on the air. Xenia,
hello.
Thanks for calling.
Hi. I did grow up on a Vermont farm in the southwestern corner, Shaftesbury in Bennington County, but my grandparents came to the county just above that from Wales to work in the slate. That part of Vermont, Rutland County, and the county just across from it in New York State is still called the Slate Valley. And my grandfather was a slate splitter who split roofing slates off of blocks of slate that were quarried right there in West Paulet. That area is still loaded with Welsh, and my older sister and I have recently joined the Slate Valley Museum there in Granville, just across the line, and have become interested again in our Welsh heritage and stuff. And the graveyard where our dad is buried there and our grandparents, a lot of the older gravestones are the inscriptions are in Welsh. But our farm, my father had grown up in that slate quarrying area, and he had lived and worked a variety of places, and then he had moved back to Vermont, and we had a small berry and produce farm, so I grew up on that, and then I ended up as an adult moving up here to central Vermont, and actually this is a granite quarrying area, which is still going strong here. So,
you know, we've been talking about the family farm and immigrants working in the mills, but granite quarrying, rock quarrying, David Waters, all those were big, big industries. There's a granite quarry right here in Concord. When I was a kid in the Keene area, I swam in one of those. I know you're not supposed to do that, but we did. That's a part of the history, too, the immigrant history here in New England.
Well, you know, it's often joked that only New Englanders could make a crop out of granite and ice, but it also shows the kind of skilled labor. The Italians who came to work in the marble and granite quarries in Vermont, the skilled Welsh workmen who cut the slate for the roofs all over factory buildings and houses throughout New England, it shows the kind of technical expertise and the desire for a new life, to get out of the mines in Wales and come here and be able to make something of yourself and not have the overlords or the mill owners run your life for you. And that aspiration and that memory runs very deep. Jane uses a wonderful phrase about how older people have an atlas of memory of all the little locations where this happened or that person worked or that quarry was or that factory was, and I think that's what the immigrant history is so powerful about, is that atlas of memory.
There are so many things that attracted immigrants here that weren't about farming, that weren't about the mills. I'm sure, Jane Brocks, that there are plenty of families who are producing New England children who find they have one foot in one world and one foot in the other. In the case of your family, there's you've got one foot in what Joe Conforti, a great writer from Maine, called the industrial ethnic New England, and you've got another in a sort of more mythic world of the New England small farm. So I want to ask you, is that an advantage to you as a writer? Does that put you a little bit on not quite all the way into a particular world and therefore giving you a little bit of distance from both of them? And how do those two influences cross-pollinate themselves in your writing and in your thinking?
Well, I think it is an advantage as a writer, because I think I always felt a little outside of each world. And that's a good place for a writer to be, is, you know, on the outside looking in, as the eye, an eye looking in. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I never felt as I was fully part of that immigrant world. It was a world we visited on Sunday. But it was just that it was enough strangeness in the farming world. And as I said before, that, you know, the immigrants trying to teach us away from the farm into a new life and what they thought was a better life sort of kept me in an area of discomfort about, you know, who I was and what this all meant.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. David, do you think that the tension between worlds has found its way into the bedrock of the New England identity in some some easily capturable fashion?
Well, that's the different voices that we hear. Jane talks about a conversation between the Thoreau's voice about New England's natural landscape and the farms, and then the ancestors in the mills. And that's just it, these competing voices that we hear. It's a great scene in her book about her Lebanese grandfather marching with other school kids, singing Marching into Georgia,
yes,
to celebrate the defeat of the Kaiser in World War I. And that's just wonderful. I mean, this kind of crazy image, you know, singing, yeah, the old abolitionist song at the end of the defeat of Germany, which is in fact a loss for the Lebanese home place of the Ottoman Empire.
And I thought Jane was making, yeah, a bid for a movie screenplay with that scene because it's so visual.
But that's why the literature is rich, is that these voices are there and they speak to us from memories and from the kind of ghostscapes and the atlases of New England life, and they're in this book.
I think one of the most poignant examples of you trying to deal with that tension is your description of your father's funeral, at which some text is being sung in Arabic, and you leave that funeral with in a state of sort of mysterious confusion almost.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I remember very clearly, I think, in the hours after my father died and we went back home from the hospital, and just I had this very clear sense, and I guess this is really what started the book, is that the farm would never mean again what it had meant to him. And that was really, it was unmistakable, this sense that nobody, it may continue to be a farm, but nobody was going to see it with the certain depth and dimension that he had seen it.
And you're not on the farm any longer, Jane, correct?
No, I just moved to Maine, actually, outside of Brunswick, Maine, and so my dispossession of the land, I guess, is complete at this point.
Is someone in your family running it, or is it completely out of your family's hands?
We still own the farm. The extended family still owns the farm, and we lease it to David, who appears at the end of 5,000 Days Like This One, and he's leased it for 6 years now. So it's going strong, and it's given us time as a family to sort of think about the farm and think about its future. It's been very fortunate and a real luxury to have him there.
You know, you use the key word, David Waters, future. What do you think the future of New England family farming is, say, 15, 20 years from now?
Well, I do think that it may be moving north somewhat, and it'll be more specialized. In fact, over the last decade, there's been a growth in the actual number of farms in New England. They're smaller, but there are more of them. And so I think we have some hope there might be 5,000 more days like this one for people to remember in ages hence.
Or 5,000 more farms like, yeah, Jane Brox's.
Jane
Brox, what a pleasure meeting you. Thank you so much for coming in.
Well, thank you for having me.
Jane Brox, author of 5,000 Days Like This One, An American Family History. David Waters, thank you also.
Well, thank you.
David Waters, director of the Center for New England Culture at UNH. For more information about Storylines New England or the books in our series, visit our website at storylines.ala.org or visit your local public library. Many libraries in your area will have copies of the books, program schedules, tapes of past shows, and even discussion guides.
Storylines New England is produced by Keith Shields. Our engineer is Andrew Walsh. We had production help from Dan Colgan and Ty Fraley. Brenda Foley performed our readings today. Our library discussion guides were written by Bill Ott. Georgia Lomax coordinates the participating libraries. The executive producer of Storylines America Project is Paul Zalis. Storylines New England comes to you from the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio in Concord, New Hampshire. I'm Kevin Gardner. Next time on Storylines New England, identity and the poetry of Robert Frost. What makes a New Englander? And how do landscape, words, and psychology define who we are?
Robert Frost, a native Californian, came to New England and wrote the poetry that helped form the New England image. We'll look at how our poets help shape our character and our region on the next Storylines New England.